web. Fly. Up, up, and away, web. Shazam. Go. Go. Go, web, go.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man.
You're listening to The Hollywood Saloon.
It's clobbering time.
A range of attributes are commonly part of a superhero's makeup, although they are by no means definitive. Most superheroes have a few, if not all, of the following features. 1. Extraordinary powers and abilities, mastery of relevant skills and/or advanced equipment. Although superhero powers may vary widely, superhuman strength, the ability to fly, enhancements of the senses, and the ability to project energy of some kind are all common. Some superheroes, such as Batman and Green Hornet, possess no powers, but have mastered skills such as martial arts and forensic sciences. Others have special equipment such as Iron Man's powered armor and Green Lantern's power ring. 2, a strong moral code, including a willingness to risk their own safety in the service of good without expectation of reward. 3, a special motivation, such as a sense of responsibility, a strong sense of justice, a formal calling, or a personal vendetta against criminals. 4, a secret identity that protects a superhero's friends and family from becoming targets of his or her enemies. Most superheroes use a descriptive or metaphoric code name for their public deeds. 5, a flamboyant and distinctive costume. 6, an underlying motif or theme that affects the hero's name, costume, personal effects, and other aspects of his character. For example, Batman resembles a large bat, calls his headquarters the Bat Cave, and his specialized automobile, which also looks bat-like, the Batmobile. 7, a trademark weapon, such as Wonder Woman's Lasso of Truth or Captain America's Shield. 8, a supporting cast of recurring characters, including the hero's friends, co-workers, and or love interests, who may or may not know the superhero's secret identity. Often the hero's personal relationships are complicated by his or her dual life. 9, an arch enemy, or a number of enemies, that he or she fights repeatedly. Often a nemesis is a superhero's opposite or foil. 10, independent wealth. Batman or X-Men's benefactor, Professor X. Or an occupation that allows for minimal supervision, such as Superman's civilian job as a reporter. 11, a secret headquarters or a base of operations, such as Superman's Fortress of Solitude. And finally, and probably most importantly, an origin story that explains the circumstances by which the character acquired his or her abilities, as well as his or her motivation for fighting evil. Many backstories involve tragic elements and or freak accidents that result in the development of the hero's abilities. And that is what we're talking about here at the Hollywood Saloon today, and that is comic books and comic book heroes, superheroes, the Marvel world, the DC world. My name is Andy, and with me, of course, is John Jansen, the Human Film Database.
Hello, welcome everybody.
That's right, welcome to the saloon. And what we're going to work on here is it's a bigger vision than just one show. I mean, this episode that we got going here, we're calling it DC versus Marvel, okay? And we're separating this thing up into three separate battles because it was just too much. It was too big to put into one battle. And so we're breaking this thing up and kind of spacing it out, you know, just depending on, you know, where these movies hit in the summer. Now, obviously, we've got, you know, X-Men The Last Stand that's just happened. And we're going to have Superman Returns, and we'll drop Battle 2. This one's Battle 1, all about Marvel. The next one's going to be Battle 2. And it will hit around the time of Superman Returns. And in between those, you're also going to get full-length shows talking about X-Men The Last Stand and Superman Returns. And at the end, when this is all over with, and we're going to go back and we're going to look at the battle and say, okay, where do we stand and where's the future from here? So really, I mean, we're talking 3 to 5 episodes covering this entire world. So it's a big thing, and if you want to know all about Marvel and DC and superheroes in the movies, this is a great place to jump in, because we are going to cover it all. By the end of the summer, we're not going to want to talk about superheroes for a long time.
Well, the whole versus idea, because I think it is fascinating. Here we've had, you know, we live in a Coke versus Pepsi sort of age, you know, where we love to have this competition between two entities. And Marvel, DC has been those two entities in the comic book universe going on, what, are we over 80 years now? Longer?
It's a long time.
And what's, I think, fascinating is they have used every medium available today to express their stories, starting from the comic book pages, going through the radio age, using television and then motion pictures and then video games and, of course, the internet. And so we've had, you know, the stable of characters. And I think the intention of the show was is to sort of trace how Marvel and how DC used their characters in each of these mediums and sort of give a history of both. But what we found is when we started doing the research and we sat down to record this show, like Andy said, it was huge. It was 3.5 hours, and it was just too much to take in terms of, it was very scholarly, to where we were just almost reading off facts all the time. So it was the idea to break them up into a Marvel show, a DC show, and then sort of a follow-up to take a look at where each franchise or each company is and how they're dealing with their characters and where they're going in the future. It's an interesting scorecard to date. I think each one has now faced their own peaks and valleys, and I think a proper assessment is in order.
Definitely. And what we want to do really is like we've said, we want to get in there, we want to look at the history, we want to see where they've gone, where they're going to, and of course the big battle royale is this summer. You know, we're going to see where it's really the two biggest properties almost. Well, okay, maybe not including Spider-Man. But X-Men is a huge property for Marvel, as well as this, you know, they've been banking on Superman for a long, long time. And in the end, like I said, hopefully, after seeing the new films, we'll be able to tell you where we think they stand at this time. And we'll peer into the future, like I said, with that third show after it's all over. So we're real excited to dive into it. And first of all, you know, we want to highlight Marvel. And that's what this is all about. This show, Battle One, is all about Marvel at the movies. And so let's jump in, first of all, to the pages of the comic books and some Marvel history.
Marvel Comics, known in the 1940s as Timely Comics, had a prominent presence in the Golden Age thanks to their publisher, Martin Goodman, who took a gamble on the superheroes. In late 1939, Timely responded to National Periodical, which would later become DC Comics, with Marvel Comics, which showcased the adventures of the Human Torch and the Submariner. With World War II capturing most of the world's attention, the Human Torch and the Submariner put their superpowers to use against the Nazis. Captain America exploded from the pages of his own comic in March of 1941, and with the American involvement in the war months later, the comic book proved to be a sensation. Captain America, under Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, quickly became the company's flagship character. A young man, Stan Lee, distinguished himself by helping out with the writing chores. The Atomic Age of Comics, 1946 to 1955, saw Marvel switch its focus to westerns, romance, horror, and humor comics because of the popularity of its costume heroes had faded after the Second World War. Marvel, in the early 50s, had another name change from Timely to Atlas after reconstruction and publication and distribution. In 1961, Marvel Comics' publisher Martin Goodman approached Jack Kirby, who'd come over from DC Comics, and Stan Lee to produce a superhero team title that would compete with the Justice League of America. That project became the Fantastic Four. The Fantastic Four was an incredible collaboration between Lee and Kirby. Both drawing from their broad experience in the medium, the Fantastic Four was an immediate success and rescued Marvel from the brink of financial failure. Capitalizing on the success, Lee, along with Kirby and other talented artists like Steve Ditko and Don Heck, would churn out a wealth of Marvel heroes over the next 2 years. The Incredible Hulk, Journey into Mystery, featuring Thor, The Amazing Spider-Man, Tales to Astonish, starring Ant-Man and the Wasp, Strange Tales, featuring the Fantastic Four's Human Torch and Doctor Strange, Tales of Suspense, starring Iron Man and eventually Captain America, The Avengers, and the X-Men. By 1963, the company, which had finally renamed itself Marvel, had taken the industry lead, riding the popularity of its unique characters.
So obviously, we see that Marvel has got a grand history in the pages of their comics. But like John said, they moved forward into different mediums. And the first real medium where comic book heroes leapt off the page was in radio. And it was huge. It was pretty much populated by things like Superman, The Shadow, Green Hornet, Buck Rogers, and a lot of these real popular serials on the radio. And at the time, you know, pretty much a lot of DC characters, you know, ruled over as far as superheroes go. And then in the 40s, we jumped in and the superheroes moved from the radio onto the big screen. And you would see them in movie serials. And of course, you know what that is that when you would go to the movies and you would get some short films and they would be serialized. Each week there'd be a different one. And the story would continue week to week. But in 1944, Captain America hit the movie serials.
When Captain America throws his mighty shield, all those who chose to oppose his shield are killed. Then he's led to a fight, and the duel is duped, and the red and the white, and the blue will come through when Captain America throws his mighty shield.
And it was the most popular at the time because, you know, World War II was raging, and Captain America, what he did was he kicked Nazi ass, and so it worked. And it was really popular at that time. But then around the late 40s, 1948, 1949, Superman and Batman would take over the movie serials, and DC would be in charge of that. So out of the radio, out of the serials, and eventually the next place that we would go would be to the television screen. You know, there had been some smaller things that have gone up through the time until we get to the late 70s. You know, you'd seen some kids' TV shows, a lot of animated cartoons, especially the Spider-Man from Marvel, like in 1967 was pretty popular. But, you know, you got Super Friends and all this kind of stuff that a lot of us have grown up with. But like I said, we're not really hitting on that world of animation because it's just such a huge thing. But we definitely respect it and count it. But right now, as we look at TV, and of course, you know, as far as Marvel goes, our first vision on television would be of Electric Company.
Hey, you guys!
With Spidey. And that was huge for all of us. I know, do you remember seeing Spidey on Electric Company?
Oh, are you kidding? I mean, I was disappointed on episodes that didn't have Spider-Man. that was always the highlight of Electric Company was just tuning in and hoping, you know, Spider-Man was going to show up. It's kind of like when you watch the old Batman TV show is, you know, will Batgirl be on? I'm waiting for that motorcycle to go across the screen.
That's right,
you know,
that's right.
At the very end of the credits. But, no, it was certainly exciting because Spider-Man was a very exciting character on the page. And I had certainly seen the animated Spider-Man cartoons from the 60s. We'd grown up on that with the theme song and everything else. But, you know, to see Spider-Man in a live action, it was very exciting because that was a distinction growing up as a kid. It's not like today where we have this sort of overproliferation of live action superheroes, even on television commercials.
Right.
Back then, you didn't get that at all. It literally, you had your comic book pages and then you might have had an animated. But for Spider-Man, you know, to see him live action, it was very huge.
Very huge. But anyways, from that, and now, you know, there was other small live action things going on. DC had some smaller shows like Shazam and Isis, and that was stuff on Saturday mornings early, and that was great. But in 1976, we went prime time. Superheroes hit prime time television. And the first one was DC's Wonder Woman. Now, that was a huge hit for them. And everyone remembers Linda Carter, you know, turning around and turning into Wonder Woman. And for the time, she was hot as hell. But really, that cued Marvel to say, hey, what can we do? So they started out with TV movies. They tested the waters. We got some incredible Hulk TV movies. You know, Bill Bixby, Lou Ferrigno, setting it up. Same with Spider-Man. We got some Spider-Man TV movies, and those were great. Those were exciting. But after that, they were so successful that they became series.
Dr. David Banner, physician, scientist, searching for a way to tap into the hidden strengths that all humans have. Then an accidental overdose of gamma radiation alters his body chemistry. And now when David Banner grows angry or outraged, a startling metamorphosis occurs. The creature is driven by rage and pursued by an investigative reporter.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
The
Incredible Hulk lasted from 78 to 82. It had a long, really popular time on the air.
And if you're going to speak about that, you really have to give credit to Kenneth Johnson, the creator of the television show, and who wrote and directed and produced, you know, the bulk, or quite a bit of it, actually. But he had had a great success, of course, with $6 Million Man and Bionic Woman, mm-hmm. especially spinning off Bionic Woman off of $6 Million Man and making its own show, and it was very popular also. Because yeah. it was, you know, the sort of the, they were the others, we were into them as superheroes, and they actually would make comic books out of those, you know, type of characters.
Right.
But now we're actually getting the comic characters that originated from the page on the show. And what's interesting is I had read somewhere that why did they change Bruce Banner's name on the show to David Banner?
Yeah, that was, I don't know.
Do you know why?
Why?
Oh, Kenneth Johnson talks about it. It was because at the time in the 70s, Bruce was considered an effeminate name.
Bruce.
Even though Bruce Wayne was an established character, and which even worse is Bruce Jenner had just won all of these gold medals, had his own running shoe named after him, you know, and all these other elements. But yet, for a major network, CBS at the time, they didn't want their main character called Bruce. So he became David Banner.
Wow, that's funny. That's funny. But you know, you had Lou Ferrigno, he became an icon. Bill Bixby, it had that.
And you had a theme song that literally just crushed us every time we heard it when it was played just properly at the right moment in the show.
Definitely.
And it was an emotional show. I mean, yes, it was a superhero show because we did get to see at least two Hulk out moments per show, right?
Yeah.
Then they usually have them paced out to where, you know, you're going to get a couple of Hulk outs. But there was also an emotional drama, you know, from week to week. You know, the dilemma that David Banner was going through, it made you question, you know, how great would it be to be a superhero when you have to carry these demons with you,
right.
Which elevated the material beyond just some sort of hokey comic book kind of story.
But eventually, like 10 years later, we would get to see what happened with The Incredible Hulk because Bill Bixby came back and he really spearheaded a series of three films, one a year, and it you know, it came to the end where we finally had the death of the Incredible Hulk, and there were some great superhero television there.
He did. He directed a few of those, I believe, as well. Was responsible as producer and the creative entity behind it. It was great to see both Daredevil and Thor make their appearances, and that was what was so great is the Marvel characters could cross over in these movies.
Right.
Unlike today, where the rights are so split up that we can't have Spider-Man show up in the Fantastic Four movie.
Right.
You know, we can't have Daredevil and Spider-Man show up together, which is unfortunate.
That was between 88 and 90 when we had those. And let's not forget, at the same time when Hulk was going on, we started getting our first primetime version of Spider-Man. It's called The Amazing Spider-Man. And there was, like I said, a couple of television movies, but the series started out, and that only lasted for two seasons, and it was okay. I definitely remember it as a kid, and it was great to see Spidey running up those walls. You know, you could see the cord though, probably, as he's running up the walls. But nonetheless, we had some Spider-Man on television, and that was exciting because for me at the time, that was my favorite comic.
Now they did two movies, right?
They did two movies.
Series?
Yep. But after that is when we got, in 1979, we had two Captain America movies. Mm-hmm. So, and then after that, we even led into a Doctor Strange film. So this was Marvel's time. You know, Marvel absolutely ruled that time from 77 to almost about 1980 when it came to television. And
it's interesting, too, because they weren't really trying to push for the big screen for their characters. Because at that time, Superman was really raking in a lot of money.
Right.
And the sequel would as well, but there would be no attempt by Marvel to go that route. You know, there might not have been a lot of people that wanted to take a chance on a big screen movie like that. So
right.
It might have been television was the only outlet for a lot of these characters at that time. I mean, I think as we talked about, when they revived Superman in 78, there was no guarantees that of anything.
Right.
I mean, when Superman came out. Because, let's face it, by that time, Superman was considered pretty much a dead, old TV property.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, new spit shine and brand new polish of paint was certainly applied to it
when
it came out. I mean, so much so, they had to tag it the movie.
Right.
Superman had the movie popping out of its logo,
right.
but not when you saw the film on screen.
Right. And that's,
it would just say Superman.
And that was another huge point in the world of superheroes. Was another jumping off point was in 1978, and that's when, you know, DC did Superman, and that changed everything because that was a huge success. And now it was up to Marvel to play catch-up. Yes, they controlled television, but at that time, you know, when Spider-Man was going out and Hulk was going out and these other shows didn't really catch on, Captain America, DC was really in control and at this focal point. And it wasn't until, you know, on our timeline, 1982, until Marvel jumped into the game.
Crom, I've never prayed to you before. I have no tongue for it. No one, not even you, will remember if we were good men or bad. Why we fought or why we died. No. All that matters is that two stood against many. That's what's important. Valor pleases you, Crom. So grant me one request. Grant me revenge. If you do not listen, then the hell with you.
So Marvel's trying to kick it up and get on the big screen with their characters.
Yeah, well, Marvel's looking for something to enter into the big screen. Okay, they don't have a Superman ready yet. Spider-Man's not ready for prime time for the big screen yet. So which way are they going to go? Well, they decided to go away. That was a character not created by them, but someone who had been in pulp comics and novels for many, many years. But still, he was a Marvel comic hero, and that was Conan the Barbarian. You know, based on Robert E. Howard's series. There's two big names you throw around in here, and obviously Arnold is number one. But really, I mean, I give this movie credit to John Milius.
I think also we need to mention Oliver Stone, who did write the screenplay before Milius, I think, came on board. I'm a little bit murky on the collaborative history nature of it, but I do know Stone did write, and was commissioned, I think, by the producer for a screenplay.
What's interesting is that I just read this, was that Oliver Stone's version was a sci-fi version in the future.
No, that's not true.
Okay, I don't know where I read that. It might have been. It was somewhere.
I've read some of Stone's script.
Okay,
remember that.
Well, that's what someone wrote somewhere, and I don't know. You know, I didn't know if it was true or not, but that would have been very strange.
That's John Carter of Mars. If you're going to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I figure. So, but anyways, yeah, definitely Oliver Stone influenced there. One of his first entries in this situation. Arnold Schwarzenegger, his first breakout, huge big role. Perfectly cast in this film. He only had to say, you know, a few words here and there.
Crom.
You know, Crom.
Crom.
You know, of course, my favorite is, you know, Conan, what is best in life?
Conan, what is best in life? To crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and to hear the lamentation of your women. That is good. That is good.
You gotta love Arnold and everything he was. He was perfect for that role. James Earl Jones as Thulsa Doom, the dude who could turn into a giant snake. Sandahl Bergman as Valeria.
Do you want to live forever?
Max von Sydow was in there too. And Mako was the little wizard buddy for Conan. But, man.
I just don't remember when it came out, it was the big rated R comic book movie.
Yeah.
I mean, you just couldn't go see that unless you were seeing it with an adult or, you know, a guardian of some sort.
Exactly.
But boy, I watched a lot of it on cable. That's for sure.
Oh yeah, that's where I saw it too. It was a multiplicity of times on cable.
I mean, I loved also how they dealt with the simplicity of his origin story, just being a slave, you know, strapped to that wheel, and having to go around in circles pushing it over and over and over again. You know, developing his muscle and his physique, and
all his whole origin story with how he learned how to fight and all those battle rings that he was in. I mean, this is really the first, you know, I mean, not the first, but this is really a gladiator movie, if you will. And not that he's a superhero, but in the way that he had a story of revenge that drove his entire life. And it's really amazing at the end when, you know, Thulsa Doom looks at him and says, "Who are you without me?"
"My son."
And, and Conan's like, "God, you know, you're kind of right. You know, my entire life has been defined so that I can chop your head off right now." So, and then when he did, whoo, remember seeing that for the first time as a kid? It's like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
He just chopped off Darth Vader's head. So definitely, I can tell you that absolutely one of my most favorite musical scores growing up by Basil Poledouris. I think I wore the tape out like twice. So just a great soundtrack and just a great movie altogether. And you know, I own it. I love it. Huge movie at the time. And Marvel, with that film, which was definitely a success, you know, entered into the major motion picture realm. You know, moving forward onto 84, Marvel would come next with their follow-up to Conan with Conan the Destroyer.
Cheapy quickie.
Now, this is the PG Conan.
See, I hated that in 1994.
How do you go from one of the most violent movies ever made, when it was a completely appropriate, to this thing? Okay, directed by Richard Fleischer, we had Arnold, Grace Jones, Wilt Chamberlain, okay, basketball star. It was his first and his last role. At least we had that Olivia Diabo, who was, you know, smoking hot.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, and I think the thing that is just the funniest about this is that, you know, we went from Conan the Lone Warrior to Conan and the team. Conan is not good enough anymore to do it on his own. He needs a team.
Well, he had a little team in the first movie with the Surfer, and
yeah, but they didn't feel like a team. They, you know, right. It was like they were following Conan. It's like Conan was on his quest. If you want to come and tag along, so be it. But this was a team, and it's just, I don't know. You know, it was nice and it was friendly, and it was just crap.
Did you go see it in the theater when it came out?
I don't even remember.
Okay, I remember skipping it because it's like, I was just thinking, ow, PG.
Yeah, no thanks. You know, it's like we saw him chopping and blood and guts flying everywhere before. Now we're cutting down? I don't think so. Listen to this. Writers Roy Thomas and Jerry Conway, who wrote the original story treatment for this movie, were deeply displeased by the final screenplay by Stanley Mann and the finished film. So they made their story into the graphic novel Conan the Horn of Azoth, published in 1990. So even the guys who wrote this were like, what did you do to our film? You know, I mean, it's just like they just turned it into, you know, a quickie, cheapy Mick movie quickie. Mm-hmm. And it's too bad. But, you know, Marvel just decided to keep on this road. You know what I mean? Now, obviously, Marvel is not responsible for these films. They sell these titles off or whatever. And they probably didn't even hold the title to Conan, obviously. But since Conan was in the Marvel Universe. But, you know, 1 year later in 85, we're going to continue down the Conan road with Red Sonja.
A legendary sword is in the hands of a beautiful new master, Red Sonja. A steel-bladed adventure of warriors and wizards, conquerors and kings.
Kill them.
Magnificent danger and murderous fun.
That's food around here.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, Brigitte Nielsen, Red Sonja, rated PG-13.
You know, again, directed by Richard Fleischer. And, you know,
well, this is like a Dino De Laurentiis package deal,
right,
sounds
right
to me. He just hired Fleischer to direct two movies and just probably, you know, did them back to back.
Right, right. So, anyways, yeah, Red Sonja, and it was a nightmare. It was worse. It was just a CD-grade movie, I remember. And really, it was just, you know, and Arnold showed up, and I know that the story was he decided to show up, you know, as a favor to De Laurentiis and do a cameo in the film. But he ended up getting top billing when it was done, and, you know, and they used every stitch of film that they could use for him. And it became an Arnold movie, you know, and it was, I mean, it could have easily been Conan. There's no reason that character shouldn't have been Conan. But, you know, it wasn't. But, you know, it was the birth of the world's getting into Brigitte Nielsen.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that she went on that year in 86 to win the Razzie Award for the worst new star. So, and we'd see more of her, obviously. But Yeah, Red Sonja, bad. But anyways, you know, the mid-80s are not good here for superheroes. This is really, I mean, we're dragging superheroes through the mud here because in 86, oh, good God, here we go. Marvel did it again, but this time George Lucas was in on it.
Is this the Willard Hike movie?
Howard the Duck.
He's like many of us, mired in the routine of upward mobility. But all that is about to change. With an unexpected trip to a place called Cleveland. A romance with a girl named Beverly.
He's my boyfriend!
Radical. And an adventure beyond the imagination of the average duck.
The duck's a lunatic!
George Lucas presents Howard the Duck, a Willard Hike film, a Gloria Katz production, rated PG.
Well, it's got to be tough for George because, you know, Willard Hike and Gloria Katz help him write American Graffiti.
Right.
And they also, you know, he paid them back. And they also ghost wrote Star Wars, mm-hmm. but didn't take credit. He gave them some points on that movie not to take a writer's credit.
Right.
And he also paid them back by giving them Temple of Doom to write, Indiana Jones.
Right.
So, you know, Lucas has always been loyal to the people that mm-hmm. have worked for him and vice versa. So the Hikes were, or William Hike and Gloria Katz had done the script for Howard the Duck. This was William Hike's big directorial thing.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously ILM was going to have to come in and do right. a lot of the effects work.
Yeah,
I don't. I think it's my understanding, and I could be wrong, but the studio did not want to greenlight the movie unless Lucas came on as an executive producer.
Okay, yeah, I'm not sure about that, but he definitely was executive producer of the film.
You know, he definitely came on. You got to remember, this was a time when the Steven Spielberg Presents was a very popular moniker.
Right.
You know, Goonies and Gremlins and Back to the Future. You know, there was, it was a brand name, and so this was the first George Lucas Presents right. little thing.
Yeah, you know, great job, George.
Because it was going to be this and Labyrinth, I think, you right. know, for the two films under that. But Lucas is often credited for Howard the Duck, strangely enough. He yeah. takes more heat for that movie than anyone else.
Right, that's what's so funny.
More so than the director.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I remember it. I mean, believe it or not, I remember taking my little brother to see it at the time. He was young, and we had a fun time with it. It's not as a horrible movie as people think. It's just kind of stupid. And it in no way follows the kind of dry and humor and wit that of the original comic.
The nasty humor.
Yeah, sort of, exactly. And
well, and I think it was an idea that just, it was ahead of its time. It wasn't ready to be done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was going to be Roger Rabbit a few years later.
Right.
Had they been able to incorporate that type of animated, you know, really hardcore Howard the Duck straight from the comic pages with the cigar
yeah.
and the attitude.
Yeah.
With all of the live action, they might have really been onto something. But then again, Howard the Duck should not have been a PG kids movie.
Right, that was the problem.
But is it worth making a rated R version of it? Is there really an audience for it? So I don't know.
Who wants to see it? Well, you know, at least we got, you know, Lea Thompson was hot in it. And I remember her being hot in it. And music by Thomas Dolby, you know, she blinded me with science fame.
Right.
And he did all the songs. Great score by John Barry. Man, I had that cassette and I wore it out just listening to the John Barry score, and I wish they had a DVD, I mean a CD of the soundtrack today, but it's actually one of his scores that, you know, has been completely forgotten, but it's very nice actually.
They don't even have a DVD for Howard, do they?
They don't, not that I'm aware of. I would buy it, you know, for $10 or something, but just as a nostalgia thing, but yeah, you know, let's get that petition going, everybody, for Howard the Duck on DVD. I know they spent about $2 million in the duck suit, and about 8 different actors worked inside of it, you know, little guys.
Mm-hmm.
And one other fun little thing was I heard that Tori Amos had originally auditioned for the part that Lea Thompson got.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Could you imagine how her career would have been different today had she gotten that part and kind of gotten creamed for that movie?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it would have been a whole different thing. But anyways, Howard the Duck. So, you know, at this date, you know, whether you're DC, whether you're Marvel, you know, everything's kind of in the toilet right now as far as media goes.
If society won't punish the guilty, he will. He defends the innocent. But if you're guilty, he gives no warning and shows no mercy. Dolph Lundgren, Louis Gossett Jr., The Punisher. Justice with a vengeance.
1989 brought us the first version of The Punisher.
Right, the Dolph Lundgren.
The Dolph Lundgren version, and this was directed by some dude named Mark Goldblatt, who had originally directed Dead Heat. Now, the funny thing is here is that, you know, obviously this was kind of a cheapy thing, but I've heard some people say that they like the Lundgren version better than the new version that came out.
I've heard that too.
I can't imagine that. I never saw this old version. Did you see this old version?
I've seen it on cable.
Yeah. I never saw it. Anyways, enough of that. Marvel was still down in the dirt. You know, everything was down in the dirt film-wise at this point. And it had been going on for, you know...
Didn't they even make a Captain America movie they didn't put out?
Oh, no. We're coming to that. We're coming to that.
Meanwhile, at DC...
At this time, in 1989, DC had been vacant from the big screen for a couple of years. The lack of success of Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, and the whole sale of Superman and the property to Canon Pictures had pretty much put Warner Brothers out of the major motion picture superhero business. However, thanks to the diligence of producer John Peters and several others, the development of Batman, which had been going on significantly since 1979, had continued to push forward. And finally, a director had been chosen to bring this dark tale of the Dark Knight to the big screen. So interest in Batman was certainly high, and Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns certainly elevated Batman's position in the comic book world once again, to where a new, different take on Batman, audiences were ready for it. But you saw this again when Marvel would do Spider-Man. There were three iconic characters in that sense. We're talking the biggest guns of them all. They are Superman, they are Batman, and they are Spider-Man. And when each one of these characters came out with their first film, the response was huge.
A secret experiment gave one man the strength of 100.
The rest of the world is just codenamed Captain America.
And the power to save millions. Now, an evil genius is on the verge of global domination.
Captain America, you gotta help us.
And only Captain America can stop him. Matt Salinger as the Marvel Comics hero, Captain America.
Now, I know you heard this name before, Albert Pyun.
Albert Pyun.
Captain America, 1991.
Right.
Funny thing is that Captain America was never released in the U.S. theatrically.
Right. I remember seeing the poster.
Sure.
At, like, at the movie theater, but it never came out.
Only internationally. Now, go figure. Captain America's not good enough to be in America. He's just good enough for overseas. This is a funny quote. Before this movie was introduced, Marvel Comics head honcho Stan Lee insisted that it was good. He wrote, "Director Albert Pyun did it so well and so excitingly that everyone in the audience at the screening kept clamoring for more to account for the film being scheduled for a reshoot." So, you know, I don't know what that means. I think that's just kind of some spin on Stan Lee's part. But, you know, I did see a trailer on this, and it just it looked better than the Captain America TV series. But that's not saying much, you know what I mean?
Look at you. The Fantastic Four.
1994. Ole Sassoon. Directed...
Is that not a pseudonym for something?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. And I don't even know if that's pronounced right, but... A movie that was never intended to be released, unknowingly, to the cast and the crew. Fantastic Four.
The first one.
The first one. Now, listen to my notes here real quick. Fantastic Four creator Stan Lee said that unbeknown to the cast and crew, this movie was never intended to be released and was made only because the studio who owned the rights to make a Fantastic Four movie would have lost the rights if they did not begin production by a certain date. So what did they do? They cheaped it out, they quickied it out, and now it exists out there somewhere new, and if you go to a comic book convention, you can pick it up for $10.
Well, that's how I saw it, was on a bootleg video.
Right. And, you know, I think that I have not seen it. Darn it, I should have picked it up at the last convention I was at, but I ended up getting a Star Wars holiday special instead because I would like to see it. But obviously it's a tragedy. You know, I mean, it had no money going into the thing, no stars. It was, you know, worst of the worst of the worst, obviously. Now, you've seen it. Tell me what you think.
It's cheap, you know, and I mean, unfortunately, I wasn't really taken with a lot of the acting in the situations, and it's that B, C team coming in, and, you know, it's just there's not enough time and care to put something that's really memorable. I mean, it's the kind of movie you watch with a fast forward button.
Yeah. Get to the action.
Yeah.
Anyways, it's got a cult following, you know, for the people who have seen it, because it just, you know, just knowing that it's out there and exists is a very interesting thing. Now, I know that behind that was all this stuff with Christopher Columbus. He wanted to direct the film, and so...
Well, I understood that Fox bought it, or Christopher Columbus's company bought this film, and they kept it from ever being released. That was part of the agreement of them buying the rights, is that the film would never come out.
Right.
So even though that they went and made it really cheapy in order to keep their rights, they might have had an intention to keep to put it out to make some quick cash on it. But they sold the rights, and part of the agreement was is the film would never come out.
Right.
So it was, you know, pretty much buried, which was, you know, the ultimate attempt anyway.
Look at you, the Fantastic Four.
Doom, it's clobbering time. You better wake up. The world you live in is just a sugar-coated topper. There is another world beneath it. The real world.
This is a huge demarcation point, because what happened here was that Marvel saw their opening. And they jumped in and they said, all right, what we're going to do here is we're going to start, you know, moving off of television and into films. Because at this point, you know, Marvel really didn't have much of a player in there for films, you know. In 1998, Steven Norton put out Blade. And that was, you know, not so much as a typical superhero, but obviously it was a Marvel comic. You know, Wesley Snipes got to get out there and kick him some vampire ass, and hey, for that fact alone, I enjoyed the ass kicking part of it.
Norton's got chops. I mean, you know, he brought a good eye to it, and he made sure that the presentation. I mean, he shot it in scope, made sure he gave it a big look. You know, a lot of shots, a lot of cutting, and yeah, he made a good picture out of it.
You know, and it's a decent movie, but I was not a big fan of Steven Dorff. I just thought he was a little too short and didn't quite work as the bad guy. You know, not menacing enough. So the fight at the end I thought was a little silly. But, you know, like I said, it really is just, you know, let's see some vampire, you know, kill in action. And that's basically what we got. It was done well enough to where it would eventually, you know, get a trilogy of these films. But it was a good thing, and I think Wesley Snipes fit the role perfectly. His martial arts were great. So, you know, this was Marvel saying, okay, we're going to jump into this now, and we're going to start off this way. But, you know, we're moving up. We're moving up. But anyways, now we're going to break into the 2000s. And this is really, you're going to see Marvel really get down and dirty here, because...
Well, the whole superhero explosion is going to happen. I mean, there's going to be a real reevaluation of superheroes in cinema in general. And their importance is going to change considerably and how they're perceived as a commodity.
Exactly. Well, and they're going from kind of being second tier. It was obvious that Superman and Batman were huge, but everybody else was kind of second tier, relegated to television, relegated to kind of cheaper movies.
Now, during all this time, Spider-Man has been wrapped up in legal entanglements.
Right.
It's important to note that Carolco wanted to make Spider-Man. They bought the rights from Canon. But they apparently didn't get all the rights because Carolco hired James Cameron to go out and write a Spider-Man screenplay. And he wrote a scriptment that involves Spider-Man, the Kingpin, Electro, and Sandman.
Wow.
And it's an origin story and a movie all... you know, wrapped up in one. And this was going to be Cameron's film after Titanic, I believe. but there was so many problems with clearing out who owns what on Spider-Man that eventually it passed itself by in the studio. See, if 20th Century Fox would have won the bidding for Spider-Man, then Cameron probably would have made it because that's where his home was. But when Sony ended up with all the rights, right. Cameron didn't come along with the package. But they did get his screenplay.
Wow, so. Boy. That sure would have been a cool film to see as James Cameron's version of Spider-Man. But yeah, the 2000s, huge time. Like you said, superhero explosion. It all started in 2000.
Sometimes when you cage the beast gets angry. No!
Bryan Singer, Patrick Stewart, Ian McKellen, Hugh Jackman, Halle Berry.
And 20th Century Fox, from what I understand, was not really supportive of this movie. They did not believe in it. Mm-hmm. They did not think that the popularity of the X-Men was that well known.
Right.
These were probably some of the factors that got the movie made was made for a price. Mm-hmm. It was not a bloated budget. It was made for a modest budget, and they got it made. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a small film when you really think about it.
Yeah.
In its size and scope. And
yeah, definitely.
They don't really do a proper job of giving origin stories to all the characters. They kind of right. do it for a couple, and right. then that's it. So it's a little bit uneven, but it is quality, you know? I mean, it finds the right tone to depict these characters as real characters and real situations mm-hmm. that make all the outlandishness of the Sabretooth and the Magneto and the other villain characters makes them work.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And, to me, I always saw it kind of as a middle-range film. I like it. I mean, I own, one and two, but it was definitely... a lot of times people want to put X-Men up there with, Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, but I personally just don't... It's like a little bit of a step below. Now, obviously, they could have made a bigger film out of this thing, but for what it was just fine, and it was great. And just the story of Wolverine was interesting enough.
And when it did $60 million its opening weekend,
right.
the bells rang off at Fox.
And everyone said, what do we have here? We were wrong.
We were wrong. There's mm-hmm. something here. And they obviously got a lot more to work with for their eventual sequel.
Yeah. Well, and they were smart because they had a director that wanted to do something right. You know what I mean? He was a great choice just coming off of Usual Suspects, which was a very good film.
Well, actually coming off At Pupil, the film he followed up with.
And okay.
He had Ian McKellen in At Pupil, which probably was on his mind when
right.
he was casting for X-Men. But
right. And of course, you get all your Star Trek people who are going to come over with Patrick Stewart, so that helps.
Mm-hmm. And you got Dougherty Scott, who was cast as Wolverine, but unfortunately he was caught up in John Woo's Mission Impossible 2, and the shooting was taking so long that he had to cancel out his role for Wolverine. And at the last moment, they found a guy named Hugh Jackman, who literally launched a career, because John Woo was shooting so slow.
But anyways, yeah, X-Men was a huge film, and it deserved it. I mean, it was a good film. Anyways, 2002 begins, and Marvel's going to continue their dominance of the hero film market, and they're going to do another Blade movie.
There's a world beyond the one we know, where the powers of darkness fear nothing but one man, Blade.
We represent the ruling body of the Vampire Nation. They're offering you a truce. They want to meet with you.
You sure about this?
They'll take us in deeper than we've ever been.
Now, those he has sworn to kill need his help to fight a new breed of terror.
Let me get this right. You want me to hunt them for you?
Ooh, so exciting.
Blade 2, Guillermo del Toro, and, Wesley Snipes is back, Kris Kristofferson. Now he's working with the team.
The team.
Which is, just cliche as cliche can be. But I don't know. What can you say about Blade 2? I mean,
it moves really fast. It's entertaining to watch.
It moves
it's
fast.
It's not visually boring at all.
Yeah, it's got some great martial arts in it. It's kind of like, to me, Blade is this guilty little pleasure of a movie. I mean, all three of them. That, you know, they're not bad, but they're not great and epic by any means. And at the very least, they have fun action in it, and they're not just stupid beyond all get out. So I enjoy them, but you know, I don't ascribe anything big to them. You know what I mean? They're definitely, you know, low B grade movies that are just fine.
Yeah, they're okay. You know, I enjoy them.
Yeah, they're fine.
They don't have a lot of replay value for me, but you know.
Well, I think the martial arts aspect of it does, but beyond that, Blade's cool. You know, I like that about him. But you know, I think Wesley Snipes is perfect for the role. But anyways, that's small potatoes, because again, 2002 is going to be a watershed year. You know, we've had those years, you know, 1978, 1989.
Well, there was only one character left that could possibly unseat Superman and Batman as the most popular superhero.
This is not a man. My brother saw him building a nest in the Lincoln Center fountain.
I think he's human. I think he's a man. Could be a woman.
He throws up his hands, ropes come out. And he climbs up the ropes like a spider web.
I see the web, and it's his signature. And I know Spider-Man was here.
The guy protects us, you know? He protects the people.
Some kind of freaky Lewis something. Wackadoo.
He stinks, and I don't like it.
Guy with eight hands. Sounds hot.
He has those tights and that tight little...
Dresses like a spider, and he looks like a bug. Well, we should all just give him one big hug. A look out,
you know who I am.
I do.
Your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man.
What can we say? Just, you know, the biggest opening in film history, the first movie to crack $100 million in one weekend. And just a huge, huge film. Directed by Sam Raimi, which I think was a great choice to direct this film. Mm-hmm. It was just perfect for him. You know, we all knew him and loved him for his Evil Dead movies, but, you know, he had had a great trial run at superheroes with Darkman.
He had. And also, he had had a great trial run at directing other type of genre movies, you know, with The Gift and For the Love of the Game, that just showed his ability to work with actors and get performances and to and to handle, you know, tone. And what he brought to Spider-Man was a sense of reality. And it wasn't flamboyant and stylistic. It didn't have a look-at-me quality like even some of his other films had. He literally stepped back and got out of the way and concentrating on just directing a great movie.
I think the thing that's great about it, though, is sure, all the Spider-Man stuff is good, but it really gives you a great sense of who is Peter Parker. I mean, I think it was really well cast, you know. I mean, for once, the high school kid looks like a high school kid, you know, kind of nerdy. But, you know, you get to see this incredible transformation. I think it was a brilliant idea, and I know this goes back to Cameron's script, to have the web be something that's natural out of him.
Organic, right. That Organic. Was Cameron's idea. That was his introduction. And I think the argument was is, you know, when in the 60s when they wrote that Peter Parker came up with these web shooters, you know, it was on the cutting edge of where a lot of new technology was happening.
Right.
But it's just not realistic today.
Right.
If Peter Parker can come up with that kind of web slinging and that kind of fluid material, he should be a multimillionaire, you know.
Yeah.
He could own his own companies, you know, with the scientific ability to invent something, you know, that fantastic.
Yeah.
But having them come out of him organically, again, it makes the transformation process that much more exciting. And plus, let's face it, having web fluid is nothing more than a writing device to put you in danger when your web fluid runs out.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's a device that you can use and reuse again. So I don't think the films needed it, and I think it's stronger without it.
Yeah.
Now, there's some Spidey purists out there that would disagree.
Right.
And they're not wrong, but I just think that since these films weren't made in the 60s, they're being made today in the 2000s, that they've made the appropriate adaptation changes.
Now, I remember when this first came out, and, you know, I was excited to see it because I've always been a Spider-Man fan, but I remember seeing those first trailers and thinking, oh, you know, the effects just aren't quite there yet. You know what I mean? And I was real iffy about them because I was like, that looks like an animated cartoon. Mm-hmm. It doesn't quite look believable yet. And I think that, you know, the final film did end up looking a lot better than the trailer did. But I think it took until Spider-Man 2 to really get, you know, up to that par.
That, the last shot in the first Spider-Man is on the quality of about the weakest shot in Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so, and, you know, I mean, they were certainly were learning, and John Dykstra, his effects group, was working on that film, or both films. Right. And they did take a huge leap, you know, certainly from film to film. And, again, it shows you Sam Raimi's approach to where, you know, it had to be grounded in some sort of reality because, you know, the Green Goblin's mask was always a big sort of controversial aspect to where it was just this big mask that you would put on, like a big helmet or something. It wasn't that it was a part of the Green Goblin.
Right, he wasn't
a la transformation.
Right, he wasn't an actual, you know, freakish mutant or whatever. Now, and you know, now I don't really know. I know that there's a bunch of different versions of Green Goblin. There's Green Goblin, there's Hobgoblin. I don't really know how it all fits in the chronology and who is who. Growing up, obviously Green Goblin was like the Joker to Batman. He was his number one enemy, at least that's what I always figured. And, yeah, I always saw him with the purple hat and the green skin, you know. He was kind of like this lizard-looking guy. But, yeah, that would have been interesting to see, but I don't think that it would have been it wouldn't have been as believable.
Well, I, you know, I think the choices he made ultimately did work for the material. He sold us on the believability of it all.
Yep.
And, yeah, and it's a series that I think is improving with age, and hopefully will continue to do so.
Well, and like I said, Sam, you couldn't have picked a better person than Sam Raimi. He just nailed it. Also, it was the first Marvel movie that had the flipping pages of the Marvel logo.
They finally put their own brand up there.
And so that was cool to see, and that's always one of the things I like seeing a new Marvel movie, is those flipping pages and how they're different from film to film. So at this point, it's over. I mean, the war at this point is over. Marvel wins at this point because they just throttled them because they put out a movie that would crush every superhero movie in box office history. The King of the King, undisputed. And I still think it sits, you know, somewhere, you know, what, number five, number six or something, the top 10 movies of all time. But just a huge, huge movie and changed everything. And Marvel was completely in control.
What's up with that?
Is that guy for real?
Yeah, he's for real.
What do you want?
Justice.
In 2003, Marvel would continue their march on the film industry with Daredevil. And it's a very interesting story. Mark Steven Johnson directed. And it came out. And it got kind of a lukewarm response.
Yeah, he wrote and directed the film. Important to note that he did take on the screenplay chores.
Right.
And obviously, yeah, the film that came out in theaters was not the film or the screenplay that he wrote.
Right.
It was the, how can we cut this down to appeal to the widest possible teenage audience version? Because there would be a director's cut that would come out later.
Right.
And my impression of it was when I saw Daredevil, I just kind of thought it was all B-team effort, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
It just didn't feel like it had any of the heft or the weight or any of the delivery of some of the other superhero films that I'd seen.
It kind of marked the way that Marvel was going to go, was that certain heroes kind of got a B-team outing, while Spider-Man and X-Men got all the A-team money. You know what I mean? And Hulk. But, yeah.
And obviously they threw a lot more money into Daredevil, from what I understand, after Spider-Man made a lot of money.
Right, exactly.
That's why you got all those extra Daredevil flying through the city scenes and all that. However, the director's cut version is a better script.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually see the care and craft that actually went into trying to create a good Daredevil feature film that would not only be an origin story, but mm-hmm. a good story, you know, along. I just think it fails in choices made along mm-hmm. the way in production. Mm-hmm. I don't think they got the best cast member for Daredevil, Matt Murdock. Mm-hmm. I don't think they got the best guy for Kingpin that they could have gotten.
No, not at all.
I don't like a lot of the let's pick the hit song to throw over the montage scene.
Well, there's really no, there's really not much of a score for the film. It's just hit songs.
I mean, a stronger score could have done a lot, I think, with that overall film.
Well, and I just have problems with it. You know, I mean, I thought the origin story was just never really explained. It's like...
Well, they explained it. He got hit in the eyes with that radioactive waste.
Well, I know. But wouldn't he have been scarred forever? I mean, wouldn't his face have melted? I mean, you know, I mean, now, not to say that his kind of visual audio wasn't awesome. That's one thing I really liked about the film was this kind of a, you know, when they showed his world.
Right. It was the first, I think, film, and it did even better than the comics were able to show you how he saw the world and heard
right.
the world.
And I thought that was great. I loved that about it. But then when they showed his origin story as a kid, and they showed him like boxing and fighting those little kids in the alley when he's blind, just ragingly moronic, you know, as bad as Rocky V, you know what I mean? Just terrible. Hated it. You know, especially the fight scene in the alley where these kids are still picking on the same kid, even though he's blind.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, give me a break. And then, you know, he does that flip where he's obviously on wires, you know, and it's just like, oh, please, you know. It's like, okay, you have this great sense of hearing, but did it improve your – can you jump better now because of it? Or is it just that you have a great sense of hearing? Because I never got that, you know, he was more agile and could jump farther and – you know, and when Ben Affleck's jumping through the buildings and stuff, and you jump in all, you know, and then he lands on his feet. Boom. It's like, hello. If you're a regular dude, don't you think his legs would just collapse underneath him?
Right.
So, I don't know. I just didn't buy it. And a lot of, and it was very special effects-y, very cartoony sometimes, just the unnatural movement. So, it just bugged me. I think it's an okay film. I watched about half the director's cut, and I just lost interest. And I didn't pick it back up. So, I don't know. Would have liked to have seen a better film. Not a big fan of Ben Affleck, although I thought he was decent in this movie. It was really a star turn for Jennifer Garner. I mean, everyone knew her and loved her from Alias, but, I mean, she went out and pulled a role that really stole the movie. And in the end, got her own movie.
Great.
So, yeah. We had hopes.
So, when did you first know you were
a mutant?
Would you cut that out?
You have to understand, we thought Bobby was going to a school for the gifted.
Bobby is the gifted.
We know that. We just didn't realize
he was... We still love you, Bobby. It's just this mutant problem is a little...
What mutant problem?
Complicated.
2003, we're going to go back to X-Men. Marvel's still ruling the roost here. And X-Men was a big movie, and it was a better movie, in my opinion, than X-Men 1.
Well, to me, it seems like X-Men 1 and 2 are really one movie.
Yeah.
I mean, you could put it together and have one really good, you know, a little bit over 3-hour movie to it. But, yeah, X-Men 2 seemed to be the movie X-Men 1 wanted to be.
Yeah. Well, you had the introduction. I mean, really great opening with Nightcrawler flying through the White House, you know, heading toward the president and stuff. I mean, that was just awesome. And so it was great.
And good casting there, certainly.
Yeah, great casting. So I just think overall, you know, and then having to get everyone together, you know, it's like we're going to have to team up to fight, you know, the bad guy. And, you know, and you get to see more of Wolverine's story unfolding. So, yeah, I just think Bryan Singer capitalized on it and made a better film, and it was a huge hit.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, good for him, you know. So Marvel just continued, you know. But, you know, in the same year, now we've already got two films out, but in the same year they're going to drop their big tentpole for that year, the movie that they would spend the most money on and the most time on.
Too high! Bruce, I can't stop it!
one of their properties that they hold closest to them, and that's Hulk.
Right. Well, I mean, they went prestige all the way. They hired an A-list director, right, Ang Lee, mm-hmm, you know, and they basically let him go off with his team and create a very cerebral fantasy story,
right,
that would, reinvent Hulk for a new generation. Having just watched it again recently, as far as comic book movies go, visually and the design and sort of the conceptualization of the Hulk is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
With all the split panels and the writing and the comic book writing and the titles.
Right.
And all of that I just think is wonderfully done. And really the first hour of the Hulk is really terrific.
Yeah.
It's the second act. It's really got a middle act problem. And certainly the third act really falls apart.
Well, by the time Nick Nolte comes in and brings his whole electric dude in, it just kind of falls apart. But I'm with you, man. Up until, when we got the Hulk out there running in the desert and stuff, it's smoking. And I think it was a very daring thing to say, we're going fully CG here. You know what I mean? We're not going to have a guy painted up green. We're going CG all the way.
Well, after Jar Jar, it was time.
It was time. So, and it was daring, but I think, they modestly pulled it off. I mean, I think Hulk looked pretty damn cool, and he was huge, and that's what I loved about it. None of this Lou Ferrigno, muscle dude thing. No, this was just outrageously huge.
Well, he was a Hulk, and I mean, the film, it did open huge. Didn't it open like in the 70s?
Well, it opened at 62.
62, okay.
You know what I mean? But here's the thing that was crazy about Hulk was it says, while the film's first weekend gross was $62 million, its second weekend gross was $18 million, which is 30% of its first weekend. It says it holds the record for the largest second weekend box office drop.
Drop, yeah.
In like history. It was a 69.7% drop. And, I don't quite understand why that happened.
Well, word of mouth got out. It wasn't positive,
Yeah.
People were not recommending the film. And, I remember after I saw it and going into the store and seeing all the Hulk toys and all the things aimed at kids. And I just thought, geez, right, they have really, they went out and hired an artist to make them a Big Mac, or where they wanted a Big Mac, or something.
Exactly.
And that's not what they got as a film. They did not get, the whole streamlined toy line, ready to go kind of movie.
Right. They got it. Like you said, it was a cerebral think movie, but when it was on, it was on.
I mean, Ang Lee is a fantastic filmmaker. So, the problems certainly weren't there. I think there was a certain overthinking in the script. I know a lot of it does come through the origin from the comics. And,
right,
a lot of these characters, they always have various origin stories because they're often rewritten, mm-hmm, when a character's been around for 40 years. Different writers have taken, mm-hmm, different approaches. And this was a bold approach to take for the Hulk. I just think there was some key elements in the story that didn't work as well as others that ended, mm-hmm, up hurting the film in the long run.
Right. Well, and if anything, if you take away the action sequences and you just look at those without a lot of the storyline that kind of slowed things down, but that gave it a human element, it's a pretty amazing film. I enjoy it. I like it. I own it. And if anything, I can just watch it for the technical marvel that it is. And I wanted to read some of these numbers to you here. The computer-generated Hulk required 100 layers of skins, 1,165 muscle shapes, nearly 200 ILM employees, and over 2.5 million computer hours in the 1.5 years it took for him to reach fruition. The computer model of the Hulk created by ILM used 12,996 texture maps and required 1,165 muscle movements. It was the work of 69 technical artists, 41 animators, 35 compositors, 10 muscle action animators, 9 CG modelers, 8 supervisors, 6 skin painters, 5 motion capture wranglers, and 2.5 ILM art directors.
Jeez.
So, and this was just for his character. Nothing else. Don't worry about the dogs or anything else. The Hulk dogs, which were kind of fun. But it really is a technical masterpiece. Let me rephrase. Not a masterpiece, but it is
marvel. A technical marvel.
It's a technical marvel. So it's quite a sight. And I respect it for that. But I think that Marvel had placed so much hope in this and wanted it so bad to be the next Spider-Man that when it wasn't, it really made them make some decisions that would affect their dominance of the film market.
Puny human.
The future was something my family would never see. They thought they murdered me. They were wrong.
Anyways, 2004, we move forward. Marvel puts out their second version of the Punisher. And didn't see it.
Yeah, I saw it.
Don't care to see it.
Well, it's... I mean, the Punisher's an odd one because, I mean, he's more of a vigilante character, so I guess he's a la Batman.
Right.
In that sense. But the whole movie, The Punisher, the new one, it's really Mad Max to me.
Right.
I mean, it took the revenge story of Mad Max and just had several visual echoes, too, of that whole film. And, I mean, you know, as far as a popcorn movie is an entertaining, you know, I guess it's fine. But I don't know. I'm not really big on the Punisher anyway. He's not a main tier superhero character for me.
Well, he's not really superhero or mutant at all. He's, like you said, just, you know, Death Wish, the new generation or something. But, you know, I don't know that it made a lot of money. It just kind of came and went. But, you know, so be it. Definitely a BC grade movie. Marvel continued, 2004.
You'll never guess who he wants to be. Spider-Man.
Why?
Well, he knows a hero when he sees one. Too few characters out there flying around like that, saving old girls like me. Lord knows... kids like Henry need a hero. Courageous, self-sacrificing people. Setting examples for all of us. Everybody loves a hero. People line up for them, cheer them, scream their names, and years later they'll tell how they stood in the rain for hours just to get a glimpse of the one who taught them to hold on a second longer.
A sequel that delivers?
It
more?
Delivers all the way. It's better than the first one.
Right.
Absolutely. And, you know, some consider it the best superhero movie of all time, you know, up there in a big clash with the Superman film. And I might be one of those people. I think it's an absolutely great movie. And its effects were up to par with the best stuff out there and just, you know, big time improvement over the first. And I think it was just a better movie altogether, you know. Just the ups and downs of Peter Parker being Spider-Man and trying to be a regular guy. You know, this guy who saves the world, but yet, you know, can't keep a job as a pizza delivery man.
Well, and also, too, I like how Sam Raimi isn't necessarily trying to go for the stunt casting for all his villains. He's finding the right actors for the
role. Right.
You know? And, you know, Alfred Molina as Doc Ock is an inspired choice.
Absolutely. Definitely. So, well, I mean, what can we really say? It's such a recent film. Everyone's seen it a million times. Everyone enjoys it. So there's nothing really we can say here to improve upon it other than absolutely. And it brought Marvel back up in dominance to the top. And so that was that.
And you had the guys from Smallville who worked on a draft of the screenplay, I believe.
Oh, very cool. Well, maybe they saw their worth and they offered them to jump in.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know they're great writers, so that's a great thing.
I mean, I think they had several people that worked on the screenplay. And, you know, eventually Alvin Sargent, who wrote Ordinary People, ended up doing the final draft. And again, it's a film that doesn't forget its characters. You know, yes, there's some fantastic spectacle. But it's a character piece, and it never forgets that. And I think that's the strength in the whole Peter Parker experience.
Right.
In the movies, Dracula wears a cape. Some old English guy always manages to save the day at the last minute with crosses and holy water. But everybody knows the movies are full of shit. The truth is, it started with Blade, and it ended with him. The rest of us were just along for the ride.
Marvel continued 2004 with Blade Trinity, which was Blade 3. And, you know, it's just fine. Written and directed by David S. Goyer. This time he got to direct this film. I think it's funny. I think that, you know, really it was kind of a vehicle for the Jessica Biel and Ryan Reynolds characters more so than it was even for Blade. And it looked like it was a setup for a spinoff that, you know, is not going to happen because Blade Trinity didn't make a lot of money. But it was definitely the team again. You know, it cracked me up that Blade didn't know there was another vampire-killing team going on. You know, he can find, you know, vampires in the smallest corners of, you know, Bulgaria or something, but he can't find, you know, this whole of the team working in his own city. Yeah, I don't think so. So, you know, whatever. I think that it's got some real funny moments in it with the Ryan Reynolds character.
Enough! It's not funny anymore!
No, it's not, you horse-humping bitch!
With his, you know, just his mouth.
You juggling thunder!
But, it's just fine. But I think that, you know, the Blade series is pretty much finished at this point. Well, I know they're moving into Blade the TV series.
You horse-humping bitch!
But in 2005 now, just last year, we started everything off with Elektra.
Yes, it's all true. The red outfit, the knives. So what happens now? You just kill me?
That's not that bad.
Yeah. How do you know?
I died once.
Which was, you know, a pseudo-sequel to Daredevil. Rob Bowman was in there from Reign of Fire. He'd worked on Star Trek Next Generation and X-Files and stuff. But hey, this was Jennifer Garner's vehicle. I mean, she made this on hiatus from Alias. And, you know, what can you say? I mean, it did not do well in the box office.
I didn't see it.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what to say. It was not good. It was just what it was. If you want some fun martial arts, you'll have a good time. But other than that, there's really not much to offer. I mean, I really did not like her character at all. I liked her better, and she was more sympathetic in Daredevil. But no, it just, you know, I really felt ambivalent when I was done. I was like, eh. It just didn't, it didn't do much for me. It was kind of a cheapy C grade. Anyways, I think what you're seeing here with Marvel is they're starting to say, okay, we want to do more and more and more, but they're doing, you know, they decided on quantity over quality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that would be apparent.
Meanwhile, at DC.
It would take the summer of 2005 for DC to finally cement their foot right back into the motion picture game, bringing their biggest and most legendary dark character to the screen one more time. This time, it would be Batman Begins.
During our recent mission to the Von Doom space station, we were exposed to as yet unidentified radioactive energy.
What happened on the bridge?
Is it hurting you, Stretch?
Are you really on fire?
If it's true, you can fly.
Yeah, I'm working on it. It's actually really difficult.
No, actually, we do not know much more than you do at this point.
That thing doesn't look so fantastic.
Ben Grimm is a genuine American hero.
What he means
please.
Is every team needs a mascot. A new day is dawning. The day of the Fantastic Four.
But it, nothing would top, to me, what I think is one of the worst superhero movies I've ever seen in my life. One of the stupidest superhero movies I've ever seen in my life, that Marvel in their wisdom decided to spend over $150 million on. And that was Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
Okay, Michael Chiklis, Jessica Alba, which, you know, she's hot, but not good enough to carry a movie. Directed by Tim Story, who, you know, was hot off of making, you know, Taxi. But, you know, and I remember you telling me, it's not so bad. It's okay. It's okay. Well, you know what? I hated it beyond all hating it. I really hated it. And maybe it's got an audience out there of, you know, 10-year-olds that would love it. And you had told me my son would enjoy it. And my son did enjoy it.
Well,
and
I think anyone that's, you know, underneath the age of 15 is going to find a lot to enjoy.
Right.
Because they're not going to come at it with the same type of expectations mm-hmm. and demands that we are.
Right.
And again, it's coming off of Batman Begins. You know, it has kind of, you know, reset the clock on expectations of a superhero film.
Yeah.
And having this come out a month later and just being so blah,
yeah.
you know, so vanilla plain in comparison.
Yeah.
You know, it is a letdown.
Yeah. But, yeah, I don't know. The worst thing about it was that it was just stupid. Unbelievable and unrealistic. It played in a world of its own that was just moronic. So I just take a big pass. Great, some cool special effects, but, you know, I love Fantastic Four. I grew up loving Fantastic Four, and they've got a huge history to them, and they're definitely a top tier, and yet they gave it this lowbrow humor base to it. You know what I mean?
I just can't believe that was the best screenplay that they
could come up with. Well, it was a microwave movie. It was rushed. It was a Mick movie, a microwave movie. They made it in less than a year. It's like, come on, you fought for this property and someone finally gets it after all these years and you're going to do that to it? Stop and make it grand, you know, give it the Spider-Man treatment, you know? But, I mean, maybe they were just so scared that they were going to have another Hulk on their hand that they went the other way around with it. They said, no way will we do the Hulk thing again.
I'm sure that played a part of it, you know, because anytime you take a chance like that and it fails, you immediately go back to safe ground.
But what's so stupid is they ended up spending as much money on this as they did as the Hulk anyways.
But this was successful for them. So in their minds, they're going to think that, hey, we did the right thing.
Yeah, and that's a shame because, yeah, they've already highlighted, you know, green-lighted part two, you know, to be directed by Tim Story. So that'll be a big, you know, so what, no show for me. But, my stomach just churns. So.
It's unfortunate because, you know, I think the Fantastic Four was the last of the big guns in the Marvel canon
right. That
they can do. I mean, I know that they have some other characters that they're going to exploit into movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, Iron Man and Ghost Rider spring to mind right away. But they don't have anyone as big as the Fantastic Four.
It's clobbering time.
Okay, so now what we would do is we would normally go to our X3 review to wrap everything up because that's the latest in this big battle of Marvel versus DC. But guess what? We went over, man. Sorry. We talked a long time about X-Men The Last Stand because there was a lot to talk about.
Well, I think it also illustrates what we do here on the Hollywood Saloon. For better or for worse, one of the criteria Andy and I have always had when discussing films is to not just try to get it done quick in our views. We try to break down what we liked and what we didn't like, and maybe we try to learn something from the process of discussion.
That's right. And so what you want to do is go over to our special edition page. Off the main page, you just see special edition right there. You're going to click on that. You go in there and you're going to see the logo there with Brett Ratner on it and the X-Men. And you just click that, download it, you'll have it, and you just add it to this show. So it's just a continuation of where we're going. So it's just got all that you could ever want from an X-Men discussion. Sometimes we break it down. We go scene by scene. But I think by the end of it, you'll definitely see where we stand on this film, X-Men The Last Stand. And it's our last stand on the world and the universe of Marvel at the movies. Other than that, what we can just tell you, stay tuned for battle number two, DC versus Marvel, and it will be the history of DC. That'll be coming real soon, hopefully around the time of Superman Returns. So keep an eye out for that as we continue to build this giant anthology on superheroes at the movies.
Our multi-issue.
Our decalogue of superheroes. All right, wrapping up this episode of the Hollywood Saloon, I just want to invite everybody over to our website at www.hollywoodsaloon.com. You can give us an email at hollywoodsaloon@yahoo.com. A couple other things to announce. I would love to ask you guys to give us some votes this month. Head over to our main page and on the left side, go to the bottom and you will see a place where you can enter your email address and give us a vote on Podcast Alley. We'd love to have that. And also on the page on the left, you will see the iTunes one click. Click that. Your iTunes will open and subscribe to us through there or give us a recommendation. That would be awesome. We would really, really like that. I want to make another big announcement. Now, last time we mentioned our Saloon Radio, which is going great, and we all want you to go over there, and I'll talk to you about that in a second. But first, I want to mention to you guys that we just hooked up with this great new company, and they're called PeerFlix. Okay, I signed up on PeerFlix. They said, give us a try, see what you think. So I tried it out, you know, and it's free to try it out. That's the cool thing. And basically what it is it's DVD trading online. This is not Netflix, okay? This is not renting. This is you get to keep this stuff. That's what I like about it the most. And basically what you do is you make a list of everything that you're willing to trade. You put it out there. And then when someone wants it, they say, hey, send it to me. You send it to them. You put your list of what you want. And when someone else has it, you say, hey, I want it. And they send it to you. But, you know, you don't have to get in touch with these people or anything. PeerFlix does that for you. And that's the cool thing. And I have gotten tons of great DVDs, and I've gotten rid of a bunch of junk that I didn't want anymore. See, what do you do when you buy the new Wild Bunch DVD set? What do you do with the old one? Well, you can give it away. You're not going to get much trade-in value for it at the resale stores anymore. So, you know what the best thing is to do? Send it to PeerFlix, because someone out there wants it, and you're going to get some points for that so that you can get some great trades and some great DVDs. I've gotten stuff that I've been wanting for a long time and just didn't want to go pay for it for full price. Here's the cool thing. Never a membership fee. It's always free, and each trade is only 99 cents to you. So you're not paying much into this. That's the exciting thing. They've got, you know, over 200,000 DVDs available. You own the movies you receive. You send and receive DVDs through the mail, just like Netflix, and you get more from your DVD collection. That's the cool thing. Trade out the junk, out with the old, in with the new. You cannot beat that. It's simply fantastic. So you want to go to our main page, and on the left side again, you're going to see a PeerFlix logo there. Now, I want you to join Through the Hollywood Saloon, because they, you know, they notice that. Well, this is your way of telling them the Hollywood Saloon sent you, and so it helps us out. So go check it out. Try it out. You will not be sorry. I'm telling you, I love PeerFlix. It is a blast. Okay, so as I said before, Saloon Radio is up. It's doing great. You need to go check this out. On our main page, www.hollywoodsaloon.com, on the side, you will see Saloon Radio. This is live radio 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Soundtracks, movie scores, songs, the best that you can hear out there, and it's always on. It's always streaming. You know, you can just pop it on and listen for hours. We've got like 18, 19, 20 hours of straight music on there. And Marty, our station manager, is doing fantastic. Getting all these songs and changing them out from time to time so that you get something new and fresh on there. It's a live 365 station. It's free to listen. We've got the soundtracks we love up there. And I just think if you're a soundtrack lover, you need to jump in, try it out. Saloon Radio. It's great stuff. I also want to mention our special edition page. Like we said before, you know, we have our new X-Men The Last Stand review up there. It's a full length podcast. I mean, it's like an hour and 30, 45 minutes or something of us just reviewing scene by scene and going through in a lot of detail and talking about X-Men The Last Stand. This is a new thing we're going to start doing on the Saloon special edition page now. Is, you know, we're not a review show, but we like to sometimes do a review of a film and really in depth. And so you can catch that on the special edition page. It's not available on the feed. If you're on iTunes, you've got to come to the Saloon to pick that up. www.hollywoodsaloon.com/S-HTML, special edition page. Or you can go to our regular page and click special edition, and you'll see it there. We also still have up there our 2006 summer movie preview. So if you haven't gotten that yet, check it out. It's a full length show talking about all the movies of the summer and what, you know, what we hope to see and what we expect will happen. If that interests you, that's still there too. Check it out. Okay, and let's get to our Frapper Map. And as usual, as you know, if you join our Frapper Map, you sign up, you leave a picture, you leave a shout out, whatever you want to do, we will mention you on our show. And we've gotten a few new entries since last time, so let's just go through. All right, I've got Ronan Quinn from Toronto, Canada, and he or she is saying, you've wrecked my weekend, guys. I was supposed to be editing, but your show on movie books got me going again back to my library to reread the classics. I recommend Film Flam by Larry McMurtry. Keep it up, guys. Great. Thanks a lot, Ronan. We appreciate that. Glad you're enjoying the back catalog. I mean, we love that. People aren't just listening to our latest shows. They're coming in and finding our back catalog, and We really want that. We don't want to be a show where people just forget what, you know, what we did a few weeks ago and it's totally out of date and no good. We want to do shows that people are always coming back to. We want to have a strong library. So we're glad that that's happening. We've also got Candace in Perth, Australia. Thanks, Candace, down under for listening. We've got Jono, and he's from Johannesburg, South Africa. He had a great quote. He said, "If modern life means that I can listen to two guys in different locations on the other side of the planet talking movies while driving my car to work in the southern tip of Africa, then live on, baby." Man, that's a great quote. Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. It just shows you that, you know, technology has made our world a lot smaller, and that someone at the tip of Africa wants to even listen to me. Amazing. Fantastic. So thanks, Jono. I appreciate that. We've got Michelle in Madison, Wisconsin, and she says, "Love the show. Found it after searching Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and I've been hooked ever since." Fantastic. Again, going back to that back library, that back catalog, we appreciate that, and we're glad you enjoy it. Michelle, thanks for listening. Okay, we've got Rick Wiley in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And he says, "I've always been accused of having an overly large DVD collection that has good movies. Now I know that I'm not alone. I plan on checking out Kiss Kiss Bang Bang based on your recommendation." Fantastic. Thank you, Rick. We appreciate that. And we've got Larry Axelson in Karlstad, Värmland, Sweden. There we go. Across the world again. It blows my mind. Thank you, Larry, for listening. We absolutely love that you're tuning in. We've got Octane in Sydney, Australia, and Octane simply says, "Kongba."
Kongba.
And we've got Nathan Stone in Munich, Bavaria, Germany. Man, this is great. We've got people from all over the world this time on the map, and blows me away. Fantastic. And we have Digger Story in Orlando, Florida. Great to be here. Hello, everybody, from Digger Story Podcast, and that's at www.diggersstory.com. DiggerStory, diggersstory.com. And that's a podcast. And I've said before, if you have a podcast, you're welcome to display it on our map, and we'll give you a shout out. So definitely, we need to go over there and give Digger Story Podcast a try. And last but not least, we have Madeline from Baltimore, Maryland, and she just says, "Hey." Hey, Madeline, how are you doing? Thank you for listening. Thanks for posting on our map. So that is our Frapper map for this time. Like I said, you want to be on, then just join our map. We'd love to have you. Absolutely. So that is it for this time. Thanks for sticking with me through this long stuff at the end here. We appreciate it. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You're listening to the Hollywood Saloon.
Have you tried not being a mutant?